This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And joining us just in time for the tax season is our tax whisperer, Don DeSantis. And one of the things I wanted to help people navigate, Don, was what kind of taxes they're going to have to pay on some of the coronavirus relief money they may have gotten. So first, let's start with the lump sum payment, the checks. Some people got them, some people didn't. How does the IRS treat those?
Well, technically, Dave, those checks are a credit on your 2020 tax return. And the actual payments that they issued were an advance payment of the credit. So let's say you didn't get a check, or you got a check for the wrong amount of money. You can fix that when you file your 2020 tax return. So you can either get the money when you file your return, or if they didn't give you enough because you had another kid that they weren't aware of, you can make that up and get the money when you file your return. On the other hand, if they gave you too much money that you weren't entitled to, Congress said, keep the money.
Oh, so that's genuinely free money then?
Genuinely free money.
Okay. What about some of the business loans that were intended to keep businesses afloat?
Well, there's good news on that front, because the law, when it was first enacted back in March of 2020, said that the government would make these loans available. And what you had to show is you had to show then later file a report that shows that you used the money for appropriate purposes. In other words, business purposes versus personal purposes. However, and if you did that, then you didn't have to pay the loan back. So essentially the loan became like a grant. The problem is that the IRS during the summer came along and issued an interpretation that said, well, that's fine and great. You don't have to pay the loan back. We're not going to let you deduct any of those expenses you used the loan for, like payroll or rent or whatever. The bill that was signed right at the end of December, this sort of the second stimulus package, Congress fixed that. And they said, you know what? If the loan's forgiven, great. And by the way, you can still deduct those expenses.
So that also becomes genuinely free money then?
Free money.
Okay, good. In terms of tax deductions, there were some changes to the child tax credit.
Well, the child tax credit is going to be, it's going to be $2,000 per child. There's actually Biden's plan proposes to increase that, but of course that doesn't affect 2020. Mm-hmm. That's a future issue. Well, by the way, Congress also said that if your employer helped you pay your student loan, mm-hmm. that's going to be excludable. See, in the past, employers could pay for education expenses up to a certain amount, and you wouldn't have to report that as income. Congress has said, well, you know, maybe they didn't send you to a training course last year, but they helped pay your student loan. That's going to fall within this education exclusion.
So that means you don't have to pay taxes on that.
Exactly.
That's the third instance of free money that you've brought up in this segment. That's sounding great.
Well, it's a stimulus, Dave.
That's right. Okay. With Joe Biden's election, he's got a bunch of tax proposals on the table, and I just wanted to take up a few of them. One of them is this $15,000 tax credit for first-time home buyers, defined as people who haven't owned a home in the past 3 years. Right. That would also be a pretty fantastic benefit. What do you think the chances are of that getting through?
Well, you know, I think that's something that could appeal to both sides of the aisle. I'm not predicting right now. Nobody's really predicting for sure what's going to happen. But that's one of those, I guess, less controversial items that probably has a good chance of passing.
And there's a lot of fear out there among investors that he is going to tax the heck out of capital gains. Has he sent any signals that in fact is going to happen?
Well, there is a proposal. It was in his campaign platform. And basically what it said is that if your income went above $1 million, that you no longer qualified for the long-term capital gain rate. That affected was ordinary income.
And the long-term capital gain rate is a lower rate than short-term.
Yes, it's a little complicated. It depends what your income level is, but it could be anywhere from 15 to 20%. But that's a lot less than, 37%.
Right. And for the standard unemployment payments now, I'm not talking about the federal bonus, but for state unemployment payments, how is that treated for tax purposes?
Well, unemployment benefits have always been considered taxable income, because if you step back and think for a moment, what is an unemployment payment? Well, it's just a replacement for your salary, right? If you had a job, it'd be income, you'd pay tax on it. Well, you lost your job for some reason and you're getting these unemployment benefits. And so the law says those are subject to tax. There's been no change that I'm aware of in that regard. So this would be something of interest for, you know, somebody who lost their job in 2020 and received a lot of unemployment benefits may find they get to the end of the year and suddenly they've got more taxable income than they thought.
So that's not an accident. That's the way the law is intended to work. You owe taxes on your unemployment benefits.
Right. It's been that way for as long as I've been in this business.
Now, for early birds who wanted to file their taxes early, because of these last minute changes, the IRS has essentially said you've got to wait for about another month here.
Yeah, usually it's later January when the IRS announces they'll start accepting individual returns. They've said they're not going to take anything before February 12th. So that pushes things back a good 2 weeks or more. And so, yeah, there is going to be a little delay because you have to think because of these changes, the IRS has to revise the forms. They have to change their computer programs. The software companies that, you know, have tax software, they've got to rewrite their programs. And so, yeah, that there is going to be a delay this year.
Something we've talked about before, and it's more important now than ever because the government is facing an unbelievable federal debt, and it's only going to get higher with these new stimulus programs, and that is enforcing tax compliance. There's a lot of money that is left on the table because the IRS hasn't got the people to go after those who just don't pay their taxes. And I know you've told me in the past that they are terribly understaffed. Is it still that way?
Well, yeah, I think they still are understaffed. Whether you call it good news or bad news, I guess it's kind of your perspective as a taxpayer. But just the last year and a half, Congress has finally started to throw a few more dollars at the IRS. Pretty much the budget's been cut on a regular basis for the last several years. But the last year or so, these cuts have stabilized. And the IRS, you know, the IRS is happy to get that money because, you know, their number of audits have gone down. Just to put it bluntly, the number of audits being done have dropped pretty significantly.
What is the audit rate these days?
Well, it depends on your income level. I don't know if I should say this out loud, but for the average individual return, it's well under 1%. It's like 0.48 or 0.58, something like that. So 0.5% chance of getting audited. Now, if you're making $1 million a year, okay, well, that might be up at 6% or 8%. But for what I'll call the average person, it's well under 1%.
Don, you should know if you're uncomfortable saying anything out loud, you can just whisper it because you are, after all, the tax whisperer.
Okay.
Don DeSantis, our tax whisperer from Clifton Larson Allen, and thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us every Friday morning for All Over the Map, which is his quick take on the stories behind the local names of places and things and a familiar sight for cross-state I-90 drivers and a relic of railroad history is soon going to open to hikers on a popular trail. Felix, this is that famous railroad trestle which, as the father of two Gonzaga students, I became intimately familiar with.
Yeah, and I've always heard that the place was a speed trap east of there. I've never seen it myself, but that's the myth I've always heard. Anyway, between Ellensburg and Vantage, familiar site, not far past the town of Kittitas, road curves around, get a nicely framed view of an old railroad bridge, crosses high over the freeway. The railroad bridge is called the Renslow Trestle. It was built in 1909, about 60 years before that stretch of I-90 was constructed. The builder was a long-gone railway called the Milwaukee Road. There actually used to be a little community of Renslow and a railroad depot. It's one of those places that even in real life, I suspect, it probably looked like a model railroad layout in somebody's basement. And one thing, nobody knows where the Milwaukee Road got the name Renslow from. That's just a mystery. And the last time a real train ran across that full-size trestle was about 40 years ago. But Washington State Parks, who owns it, got funding recently to add concrete decking and a safety rail to open it to hikers. And they told me yesterday the work is nearly completed, and if all goes according to plan, the Renslow Trestle will open to the public sometime around March 1st. Now, what this means is a key missing link in the Palouse Cascades Trail will be connected. Now, the Palouse Cascades, which used to be called the John Wayne Trail, it's probably familiar to a lot of Cairo listeners. It's the same trail that goes up and over Snoqualmie Pass from Rattlesnake
Lake. Oh, through the tunnel?
Yeah, yeah. And so that route, with a few missing links, goes all the way to the Idaho border, south of Spokane down in Whitman County. It's about a 270-mile trail, and there's a few other missing links along the way, and those are likely to be all patched up in the next year or so. Now, one cool fact I didn't know, there's a trailhead just east of the Renslow Trestle, and it's right on the edge of what used to be called the Yakima Firing Center and is now known as the Yakima Training Center. That's a U.S. Army installation that dates to World War II. and the Palouse Cascades Trail between Renslow and the Columbia River goes right through the Yakima Training Center. And you have to register at the trailhead, but you're allowed as a civilian to cross through Army property. And that stretch also includes a tunnel near where the community of Boylston once stood. So it's a great piece of statewide history, a great piece of railroad history, and a great way to get out on foot or on a bike and see a part of the state that you normally speed by at about, I don't know, 85 miles an hour. How fast you go by the Renslow Trestle, Dave,
never
typically?
85.
You remember?
Never 85.
Never 85.
But I could make it to Gonzaga in 4 hours. Although if this had been completed back when my kids were going to school, I just could have told them to walk back.
Yeah, exactly. Get a head start of about 2 weeks probably to get there in time before the semester starts.
That's right.
So anyway, exciting news for people who like the Rails to Trails movement and like getting out and about the state. And long about March 1st, the Renslow Trestle will be open to walk across safely.
Very good. Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks,
hey, Dave,
Felix.
One more thing.
Yes, sir.
Can I plug our gallery we have up? We've got a bunch of great photos at MyNorthwest if people want to check it out.
Very good.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross, Colleen O'Brien, Chris Sullivan. Let's talk housing now with Matthew Gardner, chief economist with Windermere Real Estate. I do notice that sales across the board seem to be up, so that sounds like good news in terms of what it says about the economy, right?
As I dug through the data, what really kind of stuck out at me, as you mentioned, were sales. And I say that because sales in 2020, total transactions, were up by almost 3.5% over 2019. So even through the pandemic year that we had last year, sales were still higher, which I think was actually remarkably impressive.
I was reading a piece about what's being called pandemic relocation. Is this a real thing?
It is, Dave. But here's the thing. When we talk about pandemic relocation, that in essence means for most people that they don't have to work from an office. What does that mean? Then they can either move out of their very expensive apartment or indeed sell their very expensive home and move further out. We've certainly already seen that migration away from King County into Snohomish County and also down into Pierce County, where you can get obviously a lot more for your buck. But the big thing is this, it's not really a black and white issue. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to leave the city, because in my opinion, the work from home theory, it's a little bit overblown. I don't expect everyone to be working permanently from home, but at the same time, I do expect them, or a lot of people, to split their time. Now, when they do that, it means they're unlikely to move up to Skagit County or even to the other side of the Cascades. They're going to stay relatively close, put up with a fairly lousy commute when they have to go into the office, but still move further out. So we are seeing that relocation, but it's not as extensive as some people like to think it is.
So are the suburbs coming back now? Is that fair to say? I mean, at one point we were talking about how they were dying on the vine, but that seems to have changed.
And you're absolutely right. And in terms of all land uses, I certainly expect when we start to see, let's say, more apartment developments being built, I think there'll be less emphasis on our urban centers and more on the suburbs. You do that, that's obviously going to invigorate those markets over time. And so the resurgence of the suburbs, likely, I think, is actually a real thing.
Hey, do you study long-term trends at all? Because I'm thinking there's a new book out about not just pandemic relocation. The pandemic, we hope, is temporary, but climate relocation, like long-term.
Oh, yes.
And as I understand it, the Pacific Northwest is poised as we're sort of a magnet for people who are trying to escape climate change.
Absolutely. And that's why we continue to see a lot of people coming up from California, where, certainly on the West Coast, the greatest impacts are. So you can look at Washington State and even to a degree Vancouver in Canada as markets which will benefit from climate change. So that is, I think, a real thing. These things are going to take a long time, but we've consistently seen people move here to the Northwest from California. That certainly is going to continue. And I certainly believe that climate change will be a component of the reasons why these people choose to do that.
By the way, do economists believe in climate change, or are you guys deniers?
Absolutely. Oh, no, no, no. Bottom line is, Dave, it's numbers. Numbers don't lie. And if we continue to see this, and certainly some markets are going to be more susceptible than others to climate change, and certainly Florida immediately springs to mind, as does Louisiana, and obviously California. It is becoming something now which, in terms of housing, what is interesting is that housing lenders are now being more thoughtful about this as well. And if you're looking to get a mortgage on a house, that's fine. They're going to start thinking about what is the likelihood of there being a climate-induced problem potentially in that location.
Huh. So this is being factored into the market now. So in other words, climate change is going to affect the price of your the value of your property.
At some point, it's not going to happen overnight, but it's something which is on lenders' radars.
Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner. Thank you, Matthew.
You are always welcome, Dave. Take care.
Unity update and President Biden's cabinet picks. I hear that Senator Mitch McConnell, now the minority leader in the Senate, has suggested a deal with Senator Chuck Schumer, who's now the majority leader, that they will fast-track the confirmation of the president's nominees in exchange for not getting rid of the filibuster. So we called up Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan to sort this out.
For people like Joe Biden, now president, but who spent decades in the Senate focused on process and procedure and the rules of needing to govern together, doing away with the filibuster is an uncomfortable conversation because it would suggest that whoever has the majority can basically have majority rule and push things through without concession. And that's why even Democrats aren't fully in agreement that this is something that should be done. Joe Manchin, for example, who comes from what is now a ruby red state, West Virginia, has said he doesn't support this. And for President Biden, he continues to promise that he wants to not make Republicans the enemy on day one and to find a way to govern, maybe not from the middle necessarily. I don't know that progressives in the party would want that, but at least have some degree of compromise.
So does this mean that his cabinet appointments are going to be held up?
At this point, it doesn't appear that way. His director of national intelligence, Avril Haines, was already confirmed. His defense secretary, General Lloyd Austin, did get a waiver because, remember, he's recently retired from the military and taking on a civilian role. So these wheels are moving along right now. It's just a question of how quickly can they get the rest of them pushed through. And this is all being negotiated behind the scenes.
The other thing on the unity front is that a group of Senate Democrats have filed an ethics complaint against Republican Senators Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz for objecting to the certification of the election results. So is the aim of this to do what exactly? Get them expelled, or where would that lead?
Well, not expel them necessarily. I mean, this is ultimately going to be up to voters when they, their 6-year terms are up. But in terms of the ethics complaint, the question is whether Josh Hawley and Senator Ted Cruz of Texas lent legitimacy to the mob of pro-Trump supporters, that in their objections to the certification of the election, that it was misconstrued by members of the mob as somehow encouraging the siege of the Capitol. Senators Hawley and Cruz say what they were doing was, more academic and had nothing to do with actually inciting violence. But that nuance of whatever narrow argument they believe they're making was definitely not appreciated by some of those supporters. You can see on videotape that the New Yorker obtained from inside the siege, members of that mob going through Ted Cruz's desk and saying, oh, he would want us to be doing this and suggesting that he was on their side. So this is something that's going to be debated, just how much responsibility for incitement is borne by some of these Republican senators and by the former president himself.
Of course, the allegation is that the president was the insider in chief. So what's your guess? Is this trial going to happen? And is there any chance of the president being convicted?
It does sound like a trial will happen. We have Mitch McConnell, the now minority leader in the Senate. Remember, Democrats now have the majority. He put forward a plan yesterday, a proposal that Democrats have to decide whether they're on board with or not. And that proposal would have a trial start in early to mid-February, around February 11th or so. That would give the Trump team time to prepare, but also give some breathing room in Congress to potentially get some things done, some business done agenda-wise, before they have to move to a trial. But that's the choice in so many ways for Democrats, is how much time do they want to spend, not just time, but also airtime, screen time, spotlight on a former president, and whether it is constitutional or not is another matter for debate. But how much attention do you want to continue to give former President Donald Trump, and how much are you required to give to make the point that he needs to be held to account?
Is he going to testify in person himself, Trump?
Highly unlikely.
Think he wants to?
I mean, President Trump, former President Trump, obviously really like directly communicating, but he hasn't been doing that. I'm sure he could get an interview and a TV camera if he wanted to be making his case right now, and he hasn't.
Margaret Brennan, the host of CBS's Face the Nation.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. The Baltimore Ravens got a tough loss last weekend, but quarterback Lamar Jackson? I'm not sure. He's the quarterback. Okay. I don't know. It's the Ravens. I only care about the Seahawks. Quarterback Lamar Jackson says he's still got a win. An incredible attitude considering he also suffered an injury and left the game in a pivotal moment of the AFC divisional playoff game.
You got Jackson who's down on top of everything.
There it is. After that moment, though, Bills fans rallied together for their quarterback and helped raise money. Bills fans, that is. They helped raise money for a nonprofit Jackson supports. Isn't that amazing? So opposing teams supporting the quarterback of their rival team quarterback. It's called Blessings in a Backpack. It provides food on the weekends for elementary school children who might go hungry. In the 5 days since the game, the charity tells Wave TV it has received thousands of donations.
When this first started, all of our phones and emails were just blowing up with donations, and it sounded like a slot machine going off in Las Vegas.
Yeah, comparing it to a jackpot is accurate. The total so far, more than $435,000. Blessings in a Backpack Managing Director Kim Holsklaw.
What the Bills fans have done is a testament to Lamar and the person that he is.
The deed would not go unnoticed by Jackson either. He thanked the fans, known as the Bills Mafia, for their contributions. That's a classy thing to do.
Yes, it is. And now, from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, and back at the bridge of the mothership in person, here he is, G Scott.
Man, I'm in the studio, brother, and I don't see Colleen, I don't see Dave. Ah, I see Sully.
You get me.
Yeah, I see Sully. Good morning, everybody.
Why are you in the studio all of a sudden?
Because it's Fresh Fridays.
What?
That's right. It's a new thing on the G and Ursula Show where we do Fresh Fridays, where we dress up. It could be a first date. It could be an interview. It could be an interview. But sometimes you got to dress up. So you got to, because you know what they say, Colleen, when you look good, you feel good. And when you feel good, they play good. And Dave Ross, you know what happens when you play good?
What happens when you play good? You win?
They pay good.
I don't know. I'm pretty comfortable and I feel pretty good in my sweats.
That was my problem. I was feeling comfortable in my sweats for a while, and I realized I just gained 25 pounds.
Whoa. The point is, though, when you wear activewear, like right now I'm in some, you know, nice looking black yoga pants with a professional top.
Okay.
But then I'm ready to work out. See, I'm already in my fitness pants. So I just, after the show, get up, do a little 20-minute workout. I don't have to get changed. It's not cumbersome. So.
Yeah. Well, what ended up happening was I wasn't getting in any jeans for a while. I kept being in sweatpants all the time. And then I go to get in my jeans, and I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about. When you go to lay on your bed to put your jeans on, and then your jeans are like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? They're just, Dave Ross, you don't know about that, do you?
No, I do not know about
that. Okay, there you go.
Yeah. Still wearing my high school jeans.
What?
Oh,
anyway.
Oh, wait, what a flex. What
no,
a Dave
that.
Ross flex. I'm no, still really. Wearing my high school jeans.
To do that, I really do have to suck it in. But
Dave, in all honesty, before we talk about what we're going to talk about, do you have a pair of your high school jeans?
No, I do not. I probably do because I keep everything, but I'm sure it's got rag status at this point.
Right.
Probably one of the things I use to dust the tables.
It sounds good.
Yeah. So, Hank Aaron. A special memory for me because my first job was in Atlanta, Georgia, and the Atlanta Braves were a pretty hot team back in 1974. And the station that we carried the Brave games with was Milo Hamilton, the play-by-play. Mm-hmm. And there was a song written and sung by the station manager called 714 because that was Babe Ruth's record. Mm-hmm. And Hank Aaron was aiming for it. And the question was, would he hit it at a home game or an away game? Would he break the record there? And I remember that it set the stage for my best sports headline ever when I was doing sportscasts. Believe it or not, I did a sportscast at one time.
Wow.
And so here it is. Are you ready? Are you sitting down? Here you go.
Let me sit down now. All right.
Okay, here we go. You can lead a hammer to wood, but you can't make him nail one. I knew that he was going to hold off hitting that home run until he was in the home stadium. Sure enough, he did against Al Downing and the L.A. Dodgers. One of my two baseball souvenirs, one of them is that baseball signed by all the 1961 Yankees that my father got for me because he knew the owner of the restaurant where all the Yankees ate dinner. And the other one are the ticket stubs from that game.
What was the atmosphere like the night that he hit that home run?
It was electric, G. It was electric because everybody knew it was going to happen. It was guaranteed. So the place was packed. The stadium's, of course, been demolished, but it was a big, you know, circular donut-type open stadium, and everybody was just waiting. He'd get up to bat, and you'd hold your breath, and there came that pitch, and bang, zoom, straight out to center field. And it was an amazing moment.
Well, Sports Illustrated, they've reported that Hank Aaron received 930,000 pieces of mail. Now, wow. Some love, some hate, in 1973, leading up to that point in 74. Let me ask you this. You know that there was security. One of his security members were dressed up like fans. They were strapped. They had pistols and ready to do something. Were you a little bit nervous about something happening at that time?
I was not. I was aware that the idea that a person of color was going to break a white man's record was an issue with some people. I will tell you, back in those days, I'd watched the civil rights movement on television, but it wasn't until I got to the South that I realized the Civil War didn't end.
Yeah.
And it's I did, but I didn't take that seriously. I thought, you know, they'll get over it. They'll get over it. No, they did not. But yeah, I do remember there was some tension about that, but the Atlanta fans were overjoyed.
Well, I just could not believe, like, 86 years old Hank Aaron. You want to talk about an icon and someone who has been so important. And you know, I think the best part about this, as we celebrate his life, is, Dave, I've never heard you this excited about sports. So he must have been something.
It was that and seeing Elvis in person when he came down. But, yeah.
Dave, you lived a great life so far, brother.
Yep. You're going to be on with Ursula today, right?
You
Is she going to be there, too?
So yeah.
You're going to be in the studio together, all dressed up?
Fresh Fridays.
All right. Something to watch on the studio cam for a change. Huh?
Well, I got a face for radio, bro.
Well, I know how that feels.
Take care, guys.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.